You're listening to the Incarcerated Christian Podcast, where we shine light on the dark side of Christianity and how it affects people and communities. I'm Robin Mitchell Stroud, and I'm here with my co-host, Deborah Levy Martinelli. We'll be covering a variety of topics, from individual survivor stories, including our own, to the influence of religion on our national politics. To learn more about the podcast, visit our website, theincarceratedchristian.com, or connect with us on TikTok and Instagram at The Incarcerated Christian, and on Twitter at @TICC_podcast_. Now, on to the show.
Hi, everybody. We are calling October our Holy Horrors Month. 2 weeks ago, we spoke with Dr. Steve Wiggins about the Bible and religious symbols in movies, but we just barely scratched the surface. So we've invited him back to round out Holy Horrors Month to talk about some specific movies, beginning with what Dr. Wiggins calls the unholy trinity, The Exorcist, The Omen, and Rosemary's Baby. And then we'll ask him about some of his more current favorites. Dr. Wiggins describes himself as an erstwhile academic, compulsive reader, indefatigable writer, sometimes editor, failed priest, non-judgmental vegan, and late monster boomer. He holds a Bachelor's of Arts degree in religion, a Master of Theological Studies degree in Biblical Studies and Church History, and a doctorate in the history of religions. And he has taught at Neshota House Episcopal Seminary, the University of Wisconsin Oshkosh, Rutgers University, and Montclair State University. Dr. Wiggins' areas of expertise include history of religions, comparative religions of the ancient Near East, including early Christianity, archaeology, Semitic goddesses, Hebrew Bible, the Psalms, Genesis, and religion and science. He's written books for both academic audiences and more recently general audiences. And today we are going to talk about what we already described as, yes, the unholy trinity. So, Dr. Wiggins, thank you for joining us again. We're very happy to have you here and excited to talk about these particular movies and help us unpack them.
Welcome, welcome, welcome.
Thank you. And thank you for having me back. I'm glad that it was that the last presentation was encouraging enough for you to do that.
It was so fun. And I'll just say for our listeners, the last time Dr. Wiggins was on, we talked through quite a bit of his book called Holy Horror, The Bible and Fear in Movies. And we intended to talk about kind of the what or the kind of the big picture, like about the book, the why, but we didn't get a lot to the what, like how that all like manifests in movies themselves. And when Deborah and I hung up, we were like, oh, we didn't get to the parts where, you know, like we're talking about how all of this stuff actually shows up in movies. So thank you for coming back and being a guest and being willing to do this for us. We appreciate it.
Oh, my pleasure. So starting with the unholy trinity, that was a phrase I made up, and I didn't realize that it was in current use for other sets of three movies. Horror fans tend to like to use it because of, I think, the obvious discrepancy between holiness and horror and the Trinity, which, you know, we tend to think of the Holy Trinity. So calling it the Unholy Trinity was a bit of a, I thought, a new thing, but not really, I guess. The reason I labeled these three movies the Unholy Trinity is that something was really happening in the horror scene starting in 1968, which is when Rosemary's Baby came out. The Unholy Trinity, as I consider it, Rosemary's Baby, The Exorcist, and The Omen. And I actually deal with them in a different order in the book, because I put The Exorcist last, because it's a good segue into the next chapter of the book. So that's why I tucked it at the end. But I'll deal with them in order here today. So Rosemary's Baby, 1968, you have to kind of get back into the mindset of what things were like in those days. And I was just quite young at the time. But this was really uncharted territory for a horror movie, to take religion as its central theme, a biblical idea as its central theme, no less, and to make that the cause of the horror. I mean, this is something you just didn't see in horror movies before that. Now, there had been some that had religion in them, yes, from the beginning, there are some that do. Dracula has his crucifix. Frankenstein, you know, there's a scene that where the actually at the very early part of the movie, the guy who plays forget who he plays in the movie now, but one of the actors comes out and warns against the kinds of blasphemous sorts of things that you're going to see in this movie. So religion and horror had been around together for a while, but Rosemary's Baby is a real departure. So it takes, first of all, the biblical world very seriously. It's played completely straight. Rosemary is raped by the devil. And there's nothing funny about it. It's very scary. And by placing her in a setting where we don't expect these sorts of things, New York City, I mean, this is where millions of people live. Why should we be afraid of, you know, spooks and spiritual things in New York? It doesn't make any sense. But it really hit, I think, a nerve with people. And we have to keep in mind also that during this time, there was a real concern about the end of the world. That was a very current fear that people had in the late 60s and early 70s, and even into the later part of the 70s. And in some respects, it has never really gone away. So it really kind of tapped a nerve. Now, I don't know if there's any way of tracing whether or not it had any impact on the decision of the studios to back The Exorcist. But The Exorcist, of course, has a different backstory. And it was released in 1973, near the end of the year, in December of that year. And it was, of course, based on a novel written by William Peter Blatty about an exorcism. And nobody really thought much about demons at this point. I mean, it had kind of gone the way, I mean, when I was a seminary student, and I know there were others who experienced this as well, we were taught the demons were just, you know, epilepsy in the Bible or mental illness. It was not really, you know, anything spiritual. It was just a way of explaining the world that they had in those days. And so it was kind of completely dismissed. And this had been going on for quite some time. And so to have a movie like The Exorcist be as successful as it was, based on the premise that this is real, and not only real, but a very biblical monster. I mean, demons are about as biblical as you can get. It was really an amazing change. And I don't know if it could have happened without Rosemary's Baby happening first. It kind of Rosemary's Baby sort of paved the way. And the tremendous success of The Exorcist, I think, caught people's attention. They realized, okay, so Rosemary's Baby did pretty well, but The Exorcist did really, really well. People lined up around the block to see it, standing out in December weather. It was just really a phenomenon, a cultural phenomenon. And so after The Exorcist, 3 years later, we get The Omen, which is kind of in some ways like the second part of Rosemary's Baby, because being raped by the devil, Rosemary gives birth to the son of the devil, who in some Christian traditions is seen as kind of an antichrist figure. And so this is the antichrist when he's a young boy, what happens to his family, how he positions himself to get into political power. And at the end of the movie, he's right there ready to infiltrate the White House. And so that, again, played straight, all three of these movies, no humor in them. These were taken very seriously, both by the directors, the writers, and the audiences. And I think that really changed the way that movies came about after that. There were all kinds of possibilities. And you start to see religion and the Bible, specifically I'm looking at it in the book, coming into the movies a lot more frequently and a lot more, shall we say, freely, in the sense that it can be treated as good or bad. Both these things start to happen. But these three movies really opened the door for that, I think. That's why I consider them the unholy trinity of horror movies.
And let's unpack some of the, I was trying to find my notes from our, Deborah and I got together to watch these movies because I'm too chicken to watch them by myself. But what I found interesting, I started making notes of all of the, you know, like the Bible references or the religious references. And there are a bunch of them. And I'm remembering from our last conversation that one of the comments about like when Bibles show up in movies, there are like lots of implications for that. But one of the things you mentioned in the last interview was, you know, if a Bible is thrown to the floor, that's never a good sign, right? Well, in The Exorcist, Bible hit the floor and so did the priest, you know, and the holy water runs out of his hand and it's onto the floor. And I'm like, yeah, that's not good. But in terms of some of the symbols in all of these movies, like priests and nuns and, I don't know, demons, even the Ouija board showed up. Are there particular, the spilled holy water? I mean, I was like, what a symbol for a priest dying, having spilled holy water right next to him. That was in The Exorcist. Some of the others in The Exorcist, they opened with Muslim prayer. Lots of priests and nuns and the demon sounding thing in the attic, possession, witchcraft, of course, came up, I think, as a scapegoat. Even like that scene in The Exorcist where she's stabbing herself in her, I'm going to say girl parts because we're a larger audience, with a cross. I mean, that is so blatant. Yeah, I was telling Deborah when we were watching these movies that I couldn't have watched these when I was a teenager. I didn't watch them when I was a teenager and they came out, you know, when I was a teenager. Oh no, maybe a little bit before. I don't know. Anyway, these would have been too scary because of my religious upbringing, because we were already talking about the Antichrist and stuff. And to see a movie like The Omen, oh my gosh, that movie really freaked me out. And of course, there was lots of religious symbology in The Omen. I'm going to share some of my favorites. Of course, the black dog was just coming in lots of different times. Oh, here's an oddity. The name Damien, which I always thought growing up was the same character, but Damien is a different character in both of those movies. And I'm like, why the name Damien? Is that because Damien sounds like demon? Is that, what do you think about that?
Yeah, I imagine there's probably actually some background that could be found. I've read quite a few books about The Exorcist, and I don't remember any that actually, that I may have read something that talked specifically about that. But the name Damien, of course, was taken for the child in The Omen, largely because of The Exorcist. There's no indication of that being a kind of a demonic name. And I do often wonder, though, if it's because of the similarity of Demon and Damien. But I suspect that there's some background to that we could look for. I can't remember if, I'm pretty sure that's a name that Blatty uses in the novel. So, you know, that might have been something that he picked up on. I'm just not really sure of where the name came from. But the symbolism is definitely there, so much so that that you see all kinds of symbols. And when a religious symbol is somehow profane by hitting the floor or by spilling or whatever, it is an indication that something is about to go wrong or something is going wrong. And it's almost become so common that it's almost trite. I mean, I just noticed that, for example, in movies now, when you see a cross upside down, that's the sign something's coming. And it happens sometimes with absolutely no real tie into the story. They just have to show an upside down cross. So it gets the point across that this is not good. You know, this is demonic in nature. A good example of that is the remake of The Amityville Horror, where the priest scene, which is actually quite a bit cut down in the second version from what it was in the original, which was in, I think, 1979. So again, riding on the coattails of all these religious horror movies that had come out in the previous decade. The priest scene is very short in the remake of The Omen, but they take a close-up, a camera shot, close-up to show you that the doorknob has a cross on it. Why, they don't explain, but then it just turns upside down. It's like, okay, we now know that this is a demon because the cross is upside down. They do that in some of the Conjuring movies as well. So it's a very common symbol that's being picked up on largely because of its cultural currency, I suppose, and it's become an easy one to use.
One of the scenes that struck me in The Exorcist, and I know when you say The Exorcist, people think of two things. Linda Blair's head spinning around, right? And the other thing is the green vomit. So I want to ask about the green vomit being projectile vomiting onto the priest who's doing the exorcism and onto his, what do you call him?
The stole?
Yes, the stole. And then the other priest takes it off, goes to the bathroom, washes it all off, gives it back to the other priest who kisses it and puts it back on. And it looks spotless again. Do we make anything of that?
Yeah, I think you probably should. I mean, I don't think that there's anything wasted in The Exorcist. I think that the imagery, the symbolism is all pretty much intentional and very deliberate. So the idea is that when priests prepare for an exorcism, there's actually supposed to be quite a long process of doing that. So they're supposed to fast beforehand. They're supposed to say special prayers. What you wear to an exorcism is dictated by the Roman Rite. So it tells you what you should wear. And those garments, and even if it's not for an exorcism, priests who regularly vest for mass have certain prayers they're supposed to say when they put on the different pieces of clothing that they wear. So these all have a special significance. The stole symbolizes a yoke or servitude to Jesus. That's the idea behind it. And so by vomiting on the stole, they are actually showing that this is sort of questioning the dedication to Jesus that the priest has. And you'll notice that throughout the whole exorcism scene, which is quite prolonged, that the real theme is questioning whether the priests are really dedicated to what they say they are. And so it's undermining the credibility of the priest. I think that really in that movie, the target is not Linda Blair, it's not Regan McNeil. The target is the priest. The demon is after the priests. And so the backstory, of course, is he's had a long battle with Father Marin, who's the older priest. And so that was the scene in Iraq at the beginning. That's where they first met. And so they're still having this ongoing battle. But getting Father Karras or Damien as a bonus is definitely something that the demon seems to have in mind from the beginning.
And they both die. I mean, can we say that? I don't think that's a spoiler, right?
I mean, it's such no, I think the movie's old enough.
Like, I didn't know that. I didn't, because I haven't seen the movie. I'm like, no, but both of the priests died, but she was saved. So I found that interesting. I want to go back to what you talked about with the older priest being in, he was in Iraq, right? And he found the head of, what was that? Was that a symbol for the devil?
No, actually, it's named in the book, but not in the movie. It's a demon named Pazuzu, and that particular demon is, well, to understand demons, really, and this is kind of getting into the book Nightmares of the Bible, but
that's all right. Get into it.
Understand, yeah, for Mesopotamia, where, I mean, demons have been around since recorded history. People in every culture have made reference to them in some way or another, but they're often very different kinds of beings. They're not always the same thing. The Mesopotamians did not think of demons as evil. They were simply kind of like a force of nature. And if you were in the way, yes, you were going to get hurt or killed. That's just the way it is. But they weren't evil. They were just simply part of the world as it existed. And Pazuzu is one of those demons. He's a very scary looking guy, but he is not evil. He's simply, he's a symbolic of the wind, actually. I think it's the east wind is his main domain. And of course, the east wind in the Middle East is a sirocco. It's a big dust storm, sandstorm. It can be quite devastating and dangerous. And so this demon is in control of that kind of wind. That's what he does. But in the movie, he is not named. And I think that's intentional because the implication by the end of it is that this is the devil himself, and not just your garden variety demon. So we've got a real kind of escalation of the evil here. Now, interestingly enough, in the sequels to The Exorcist, they do name the demon. They call him Pazuzu in the movies, and he's named in the novel. They didn't put it in the movie, though, again. So I think that was probably William Friedkin thinking that the movie will have more appeal if we don't make it specific to one demon, but make it the devil, something that's really much more frightening. And going back to Rosemary's Baby, we've seen the devil before in that movie, and in some sense we'll see him again in the Omen.
Oh my goodness, the Omen. The Omen was the one that freaked me out the most. I think it's because of my religious upbringing, because we were, you know, end times people and lots of talk about the Antichrist, you know, and all this stuff. The 666. So all of the tradition around 666 having to be on the person, and they found it in form of a birthmark on his head. Am I getting that right?
Yes. Mm-hmm.
And the symbology, I never understood the symbology of 666. You go into that, I think, a little bit in your book.
Yeah, I talk about it a little bit. Yeah. It's really, again, one of those matters that culturally has been blown out of proportion, because it's a very brief mention in the book of Revelation. That's the only place it occurs once. And it's probably in context, a reference to Nero, the emperor. simply because you couldn't come right out and say that if you were writing during Nero's reign. You can't condemn the emperor. That just is foolhardy and stupid. So nobody would do that. And so it's veiled in heavy symbolism, and they use this old form of recounting that numbers have significance. This is a part of the Hebrew tradition, Hebraic tradition, or Hebrew Bible tradition, Jewish tradition, and it gets carried into early Christianity as well, that numbers have some significance. And so there are various ways you can unpack that, but basically it's understood as three is the number for divinity, and so six is the number for undivinity or anti-divinity, and so it becomes three sixes, becomes the Antichrist.
So I have another question about the omen, and that is the, I don't even know what to call it, the post or the pole at the top of the building that is then captured by the photographer over and over and over as some sort of symbol, and then ultimately, again, spoil alert, perhaps, that post impales someone, right?
Yeah.
What are we looking at there?
You know, I think this is actually maybe one of those cases of just plain old foreshadowing. It's being shown as the means of the death of the person. So whoever's in the picture where it shows up, and it can be take different forms. It's the pole for the priest. He gets impaled by it. For the photographer himself, it becomes a plate of glass. It's going to behead him. And I believe for the nanny at the beginning, it's a noose. So it's a way of showing what's going to happen. And I think that the underlying message, though, is that this has all been planned in advance. God has planned this out. And so there are no mistakes. And it's being revealed in a kind of way of the Bible revealing to the photographer. And notice also when he has to explain to Thorne, the ambassador, what's going on, it's always the photographer who's been looking it up in the Bible. He's the one that explains everything. He's the one that's done the research. Thorne is just, you know, full of parental angst and concern about things, but it really is the explaining, the revelation, if you will, that's taking place as the movie goes on, and that is really the kind of unveiling, if you will, of the evil behind this episode.
Well, you said a couple of things there that sparked my imagination. One is that we have all these little omens that show up in the movie with like portending death, but we have the big omen, which is the prophecy, which I never understood. Of course, I've never seen the movie until recently, but I didn't understand that there was a big P prophecy. I guess because I never learned that much in my church. But will you share for our listeners just what sort of the prophecy was, or the omen? Like, what is the omen in the omen?
Yeah, I think it is the idea that there is going to be an Antichrist. And that idea, of course, is really post-biblical and sort of fabricated over time, because the Bible doesn't make reference to the Antichrist. There are Antichrist figures in the Bible. Anybody who's against Jesus is an Antichrist, but there isn't the Antichrist as a kind of end of the world figure. Again, we have to go back to the book of Revelation for that, where the beast, whose number is 666, and the Antichrist, or the false prophet, I guess is called in that instance, are thrown into the lake of fire, which burns forever and ever. And so we've got this idea coming in the book of Revelation. But the omen is that it's based on it's actually an evangelical construct of history, because this is not accepted by Roman Catholics, or many varieties of Protestantism don't accept this as well. But the idea is that there, in this brand of evangelical Christianity, is that there is a roadmap to the end of time, and part of that roadmap involves these characters that are mentioned. So the beast, the Antichrist, has to come in a certain time frame as it's laid out. And so it reads the book of Revelation like it's a roadmap to the end of time, which again is basically misunderstanding the way the book was written and what its intention was. But they use that as the means of moving the plot along in the movie, but also as kind of the idea that this omen is the indication that this is about to happen. And the omens, they build up cumulatively throughout the movie. Of course, the child Damien is the child of a jackal. It's his mother. And so that's a bit of a problem there. That's an omen, obviously. The burning down of the hospital is an omen. The deaths of these various people, some of whom are more innocent than others, are an omen. The jackals or big dogs coming at the cemetery as an omen. All of this is kind of pointing to, if you will, to try to convince Thorne that this is actually happening. And of course, he ends up trying to kill Damien at the very end, but doesn't succeed and gets shot himself. And so the omen is essentially unheeded, and the devil succeeds, you know, because the Antichrist moves on to the next step.
So that leaves it open for the next book and the next movie.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. That scene, though, where Thorne, and I find his name interesting, all I could think about was the crown of thorns, but that scene where he takes his child, kind of drags him up the church aisle and puts him on the altar to stab him, was so reminiscent of the sacrifice of Isaac.
Yes.
And
yes.
That gets thwarted too. I mean, it was like it's the inversion of that in some ways on the evil side. We're thinking about good and evil. Yeah.
I think you're absolutely right. I think that what they're doing here is showing inversions throughout. And that scene, of course, is a particularly hard one to watch for anybody who's a parent or even, you know, just has a fondness for children. But it's a very difficult scene to watch. And it really does kind of subvert your expectations, because you think, this is a grown man against a child. What chance does a child have? And yet he doesn't win. And so, again, the nature of the omen, this the Antichrist, will succeed. And, of course, in the evangelical construction of history, that does happen at the end of time. The Antichrist does succeed, is given free reign on earth for a while until the second coming. And so this is part of the narrative.
Mm-hmm. Hey, and before we leave the topic of the omen, because I that makes me think of another kind of area I would love for us to go to. Would you mentioned that this is sort of not really the intention of Revelations, right? What was Revelations intended to be?
Well, I think that the best explanations that I've ever read about this, and I took a couple courses in it over the course of my education, are that it was a message of hope to people who are being persecuted. So there was a very real possibility. It wasn't nearly as bad as is described by some historians. There's a very real possibility that if you were a Christian in the first century, going into the second century, you could be killed for it. As far as we know, the Romans did not go around knocking on doors looking for them. But if you made trouble, if you made yourself a spectacle, if you got out there and tried to be very vocal about it, yeah, they would shut you down, because it was considered to be a very disruptive form of religion. And so that was kind of the background in which Revelation was written. It was a message of hope to these Christians who were feeling persecuted. And it's a form of literature which is called apocalyptic by scholars. Apocalyptic really describes only two books in the Bible. One is the book of Daniel and one is Revelation. The two are very similar in many respects, in that they use heavy symbolism and various stock characters, if you will, to illustrate some hidden meanings. And so anybody who really understood what was going on, that this was not really a message about what's going to come in the future, it's about what's happening now, would have understood that, you know, the beasts, these are Roman emperors. These are, that was spelled out even as early as Daniel, not for Romans, but the beasts in Daniel are specifically spelled out as being emperors of various world powers at the time. And so these are all understood by people who understood what apocalyptic was. When that gets lost, we start to think, oh, it must be taken literally. And that's the way Revelation has been taken by evangelical Christians, particularly for many years. They have understood this as being the literal roadmap to the end of the world. Whereas most other forms of Christianity don't see it that way. They see it as being somewhat unusual. As a matter of fact, in the Orthodox faith, the Orthodox varieties of Christianity, many of them do not include Revelation in their Bible. It's not necessarily something they think is useful for us to have. And so it really is kind of an evangelical interpretation of Revelation that makes these movies possible.
That is so helpful for me to hear as one of those evangelicals raised with, you know, these beliefs. I mean, so scary. Revelations is so scary. Less scary to me now. Thank you. Okay, but Deborah, I'm about to left turn. Do you want to jump in there on anything else related to the unholy Trinity before I left turn?
Yes.
Okay.
I want to do just sort of a gradual turn, not a complete left, and ask you to talk Steve, a little bit about Rosemary's Baby, the movie that started it all.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think Roman Polanski, the director, was already kind of a bad boy when he decided to take this movie on. He actually dealt with taboo subjects before. And I think this maybe was a chance. He was taking a chance on this movie. Would people actually go for the idea that a woman is physically raped by the devil and has his son? And I think the reason that it worked for him was that it built around the idea of a kind of a conspiracy that she didn't know about, nobody knew about. I mean, the older couples in the building, the older couples, there are many of them in the building, are all grandfatherly, grandmotherly. They're just the people next door. They're not doing anything bad. And to think that these people could be keeping this secret and they have, that they were really witches. And it does make that point in the movie that this is a coven of witches who are trying to summon the devil. That was just something nobody would take seriously. But the movie presents it in a way that you're kind of forced to. And say, you know, this could happen. How well do we really know our neighbors? And do we know what's going on in their private lives? And maybe they are Satanists. Maybe they do worship the devil. So these are really, I think, unspoken fears that were around at that time. And again, the Vietnam War was going on. There's a lot of distrust of the government. Who can you trust? There was a real concern, I think, that the powers as we know them were not trustworthy. And so the movie plays into that. And I think it brings that to a different level. And so we have to ask ourselves, you know, what is the point of the movie? Well, the director makes a movie for any number of reasons, but I think he was trying an experiment to see if this could work. And he was right. It did. It just really caught people completely off guard. Of course, it was based on a novel, I think it's a novel, not a play, by Ira Levin. Interestingly enough, a Jewish writer who made this story about the Christian, essentially, end of the world sort of scenario, but it works.
I have one follow-up question on that, and this is just curiosity. With respect to Roman Polanski, at which stage in we know of his legal troubles? I think we all know about his legal struggles. If you don't, listeners, you can look it up. But where chronologically did this movie fall in terms of what was going on in his own life?
That's a good question. I haven't researched that recently, so I'm going to have to kind of just say I don't really know. I think it was before this became a serious issue. So he still had the respectability of his career going into the movie. And I think he kept it for a little while after it, but because these revelations came out slowly over time, as often happens. So people start saying, that doesn't look right, or this doesn't add up. And so his reputation suffered, but I think it was after the movie.
So I want to make a final note about the Unholy Trinity too. Our eldest son's best friend, Marley, is a total horror film fanatic and was so excited. I actually got a copy of your book for him. It's coming. It's on the way. But he was saying of the Unholy Trinity, of those three movies, and he wasn't raised evangelical. He wasn't raised with, you know, these end time beliefs. So of the three, Rosemary's Baby was the scariest for him when he first watched it. And, you know, these are young 20-year-olds, because it was the most believable to him. Like this could really happen. That was kind of like, which was so striking to me. And that's before, you know, watching the movies. But to me, I guess I'm freaked out by all of them. Who am I kidding? Oh, well. But anyway, those movies still have, you know, great impact. So I thought it's just fun to hear it from a young generation. I would like to hop over to Bible verses. When we were talking about revelations, it made me think of how often Bible verses get used in horror movies, kind of either set the stage or that. And the one that I still remember from when I first read your book is, and a child shall lead them. And that is the whole premise of Children of the Corn, right? Would you unpack that a little bit? And a young child shall lead them. Is that in Isaiah? Anyway, children, that set up the whole Children of the Corn movie, which is the one movie that I did see when I was a teenager and, of course, freaked me out. But anyway, yeah. Will you talk about that a little bit?
Yeah. Stephen King, of course, this is based on a Stephen King short story, has been vocal and recognized for a long time as being kind of aware that religion and horror work together. I toyed with the idea of actually putting in this book a chapter on Stephen King as and horror. And actually, a colleague of mine, Douglas Cowan, has written a book called America's Dark Theologian, which is about Stephen King's theological bent in his books. So there, I think that's quite intentional. And King, I think, is very well aware that the Bible as a symbol can be used without question. If it's in the Bible, it's true, right? And so the matter, of course, of how you interpret it, that's another story. And that's how it all plays out, is that these children and children of the corn are taking this verse literally, or taking this idea literally, that they are the righteous ones and they are getting rid of the nasty adults who have fallen away. And so it becomes the kind of justification for living out, you know, childish fantasies that we sometimes have of taking over the world and whatnot, which they literally do in this small town in Nebraska.
Yeah.
So it's something they, I think they simply use the fact that the Bible can be the unquestioned authority and take that to run with. And I think that's quite often how it occurs in horror movies, is that you never question it. If it's in the Bible, it's true. And that's a very American kind of perception. And it really kind of works for American movies.
Well, and the one thing that you emphasize in your book is it doesn't even have to be in the Bible, because our biblical literacy is not very high. All anybody has to say is that it's in the Bible and people will believe it's in, or it just has to sound biblical.
Yeah, yeah.
And that often people works. Will believe it. Yeah.
Yeah, it often works. But interestingly enough, there's, I always like to bring in the case of Constantine here, which is kind of an unusual movie in many respects, of course, based on a graphic novel. And so it's kind of different than the others in some respects. But the idea that they had some verses in the Bible that they wanted to use that weren't in the Bible, and so they simply made up another part of the Bible. So they added some chapters to the book of Corinthians. I think they just call it Corinthians. Of course, in the Bible, there's first and second. But they add some material and they say it's in hell's Bible and the Bible that comes from hell. So there's a separate Bible that has its own material in it. And you can get away with that because, you know, you won't find it in your Bible if you look it up. I think that really most producers and writers are well aware that people, unless they're really biblically literate, aren't going to go through the trouble of looking something up. It's a big book. They're not going to read the whole thing. And unless they're aware of concordances or these days Bible software that helps you look stuff up, how are you even going to find it? I mean, it's just a not really worth it. So you simply accept what the movie says. And I think a lot of producers or directors, I should say, and writers are aware of that and use it.
I want to go back to your comment just a few minutes ago about saying that literalism, if you will, is strictly American. Explain to us how the rest of the world might interpret how American horror movies are using Bible and religious symbiology. How do they see what we're doing here?
That would be a good question to ask people from other cultures, because the horror from different cultures is quite different from American horror. There is some religion in it. You can see it, for example, in The Wicker Man, which is one of the very few non-American movies I discuss in the book. Interestingly enough, I was watching that again recently and noticed the scene with the Bible in it that I hadn't even noticed before. So I keep on coming back and finding more things. But I think they must think it's somewhat, well, let's put it this way. Given our politics, what they see happening in world politics, they're probably not as surprised as they might have used to be about this kind of idea. But the idea that we're very easily swayed by the Bible must stand out to other cultures. Now, it's not only American. There is a fairly strong movement of evangelical Christianity in Australia, interestingly, for example. And there are pockets of evangelicalism elsewhere. There are some in Britain. There are some in Germany. I know evangelicals in both countries. So it does happen elsewhere, but it's not the political force that it is in the United States. And so I think really what it comes down to is the tie-in with politics, the religion and politics together, which were the two things when I was growing up they were told never to talk about in polite company. You don't talk about religion or politics. Now it's on the table and they are clearly working together to sort of make their own new world order, if you will. And it's just, I think the rest of the world sees it and is kind of afraid that we haven't gotten beyond literalism, which is something that kind of the rest of the world left behind a couple centuries ago. So this is a little bit strange.
I remember my husband and I hosted a student, I think from Germany, one time, and we invariably turned to the topic of religion, and he was genuinely confused. He just didn't understand all of the denominations in America. You know, he's like, well, we have Catholics and we have Protestants. Why do you all have like all of these different branches? Like it did not compute. And it was like, over here, if we don't like what our church is doing, we'll just break off and start our own. And we have all of these schisms that don't exist in other parts of the world. And it was the very first time that I realized that the way we do religion is not the way everybody does religion.
Yeah, it's very different. I mean, the figures that I see are that there are somewhere in the neighborhood of 40,000 different Christian denominations, Christian and Jewish denominations in the North America. And that's an incredible number, because somebody gets offended and decides they're going to take their belief elsewhere. So,
did you say 40,000?
Yes.
Wow. I did not know it was that many. I knew it was a lot, and it's hard to keep track of all of them. Yeah.
Yeah. Most of them are fairly small.
Yeah.
But they branch off from other groups. So if you say, like, what is a Baptist? Well, it depends on what kind of Baptist you mean. There's lots of different kinds.
Exactly. Yes. Yes. And that was part of the challenge for me, is not understanding my own history, because I grew up as a Southern Baptist. Yeah. And not being able to get to the root of, like, where did we come from? You know, because there are just so many kinds of us.
Yes. And I will ask you two religious scholars this question. I'm wondering if we are going through all of this and have been for a while, America, because we're such a young country, and Europe, for example, had thousands of years maybe to work through some of these issues, and we're just getting there now. Is that even a remote possibility in terms of figuring this out?
I think so. I mean, I'm not a political scientist, but I do think that we are still trying to figure out who we are as a country. And that's one of the reasons that things like these movies are so edgy, and so they push the envelope so much, because we are still trying to sort it out. And I mean, there's this kind of strange inferiority complex, but also hatred of European culture. So we're different. We're Americans. We're not Europeans. But yet, if we want to look for something that's cultured and sophisticated, we look to Europe. I mean, it's just kind of a very kind of almost a deep-seated insecurity. And one thing that evangelical religion does is it plays very well into insecurity. It works very well together with it.
It doesn't play into it. It creates it.
Yes. Yeah. Not to put too fine a point on it. Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Sorry, that's where it creates it. It forms.
That's where you come from.
Yeah, that's where I come from.
Again, that's not my area of specialization. So I'd say that I think there's probably something to that. And one of the things with America, of course, is you get people from all over the world coming together, bringing in different influences. But those who want to assimilate have to accept the Christian culture that we have, this overlay.
Yeah.
And it makes for a very powerful political tool, and also makes for a way of people being able to just make themselves fit. And as they do so, then they, of course, when they see movies like these, they watch them and they understand, or at least, you know, start to understand where we're coming from. Whereas I think people overseas that see these movies, I think they see their coherent, and they kind of give a story, but they probably aren't as easily scared by the religion elements as Americans tend to be.
Yeah. And, you know, I was thinking as you were saying that probably the reason I didn't watch these growing up is that I wasn't permitted to, because we couldn't watch anything that would, you know, like influence our walk, you know, like, and those horror movies that use symbology in these ways, I'm sure we were told no, no, no. I remember very distinctly in college, is it The Last Temptation of Christ?
That came out.
Was that the really controversial one? And the churches were like, do not go see that movie. Well, I ended up seeing it at a campus ministry outing where they were like, yes, come, let's watch this movie and let's talk about it, which of course I loved. But that was really boycotted because, of course, it tells a different story for around Judas. And wow, it just blew my mind when I watched it. But I'm sure I was discouraged from watching these kinds of movies growing up.
Yeah. And ironically, that often has the opposite effect of what's intended. I mean, when the Catholic Church comes out against a movie, it becomes very popular and successful. And when parents tell their children don't watch these movies, they're going to watch them, of course. I mean, so why not be open about it? But yeah, The Last Temptation of Christ was interesting in that respect. And of course, that movie was written by, the screenplay was based on a novel by an Orthodox Christian, which is interesting. He was playing with this idea of this being a vision of Jesus while he's being crucified. But of course, people said, well, what if this is all being taken literally? You know, he gets married and has family. That's not right. And so, you know, taking basic human temptations and saying this could never happen to Jesus. But it really was written with religious motivation involved. It just wasn't evangelical or Catholic, for that matter.
I love these days when those kinds of things get turned upside down. My our oldest son, Augie, told me about a series that he watches where the devil just decides to quit hell. He's like, I'm done. I don't want to lead hell anymore. And I was like, wait, what? Like, that would never even occur to me that, you know, like maybe the devil just wants to quit hell and he pieces out, right? Check out. Oh, okay. Now, let's see. There was something that you said that I was going to follow back around on. Oh, I can't remember now.
Go to The Shawshank Redemption. You wanted to ask about that one.
Yeah, there are several movies that I love that are more modern that I've seen. Shawshank was one of them. And I can't remember if we talked about this in the last episode, but the religious symbology in there isn't quite the same kind of horror, right?
Right. Yeah. And it's not really, I don't think it's necessarily a horror movie. I think horror, and we did talk a little bit about this last time, is pretty much defined by the viewer, and certain things in that movie, the violence in the prison, being incarcerated, that is horror to some people. And it was written by Stephen King. Okay. So I'm going to give him almost anything by Stephen King for me. I know he doesn't always write them as horror, but it says there are horror elements to it. But the religious element is one of the reasons I put it in there. I just couldn't overlook that. The idea that the salvation comes in the form of a Bible that's hollowed out so that you can put a gun in it. I mean, this is just, it really is too good to pass up. And so taking the fact that it has horror elements to it and it has Stephen King pedigree, I thought it was good to discuss it there. But it does have more positive outcome, depending on who your character that you're rooting for. If you're the warden, it's not such a good outcome.
Yeah.
But, and he's the religious one, right?
Yeah, so, yeah.
Yeah.
That's part of what I loved about it is that, you know, the Bible, the gun hidden in the Bible served him. And he's supposed to be this religious man. He's a hypocrite, of course, and other things. And then it ends up being his undoing.
Yeah, so, that's very Stephen King. Very Stephen King.
Yeah, I love that. It kind of gets, again, inverted. So can we talk about another couple that I really love? One is Stigmata. Stigmata with all of the religious symbology. Can you describe for us what Stigmata is? Because that's really the whole gist of the movie, right?
Yeah, it is. Stigmata is, it's an actual thing. It does happen. It's usually explained as being self-inflicted or some kind of psychological thing. But it's a condition where a person, usually a very religious person, comes down with bleeding from either the palms of the hand or the wrists, depending on how much they know about crucifixion. Because when somebody was crucified, if they used nails, they put them through the wrist because a nail through the hand would simply rip through under the body's weight. It wouldn't hold the body and the feet. And sometimes they get a wound in the side. So these bleeding wounds appear on a person, a living person, and don't have any obvious physical cause. And so sometimes they'll say it's self-inflicted. We weren't watching and the person did this to themselves. Other times it's thought to be a kind of a mind over matter sort of thing where the mind has become so religious that it brings these wounds that are wounds typical of the crucifixion story of Jesus onto a person's body. And in the movie Stigmata, I think it's one of the underrated horror movies. People tend to not give it a very high rating. I think it's actually quite well done because it explores what happens if an atheist gets the stigmata. I mean, how do you explain this? Of course, they come up with a backstory, which is how I bring the Bible into it, because it's about a lost book of the Bible that gets brought into the story and is being suppressed by the Roman Catholic Church. And the reason that Frankie gets the stigmata in the movie is to bring attention to the fact that this book has been suppressed. It's the Gospel of Thomas, really, in real life. That's where most of the verses are taken from, which, of course, is not in the Bible, but it is a real book. And so that fuels the entire story. And I thought it was pretty well done, actually.
I love that one. I don't know why it probably is because she's not a religious figure. She's everything, you know, anything but. And yeah, so why was she chosen?
Yeah, and the way that it brings her out as kind of a Saint Francis figure at the end is really quite good too. So there's a lot of religious symbolism in the way she's standing and the animals are acclimated to her. It's all very much like she's the real saint here, not the priests. The priests are the
exactly.
bad guys. Yeah.
Yeah.
So I get
that's oppression.
Yeah, you can see it as kind of anti-Catholic, but I don't really think it is. I think it's more of an exploration, a thought experiment, if you will.
Yeah, it's a good one. I was curious. I remembered my earlier question. I'm curious about how people receive your work. Well, I'm more curious about how religious folk receive your work.
I don't know if they do.
I don't know. I don't know that I could have gotten away with thinking about, you know, all of this stuff when I was growing up and that in my environment. Yeah.
Well, I don't get a lot of feedback about it. So there's, I haven't had anybody approach me and tell me how wicked I am for writing these books. But I do think that there obviously would be some doubting of my analysis. I'm sure of that. And there would be some concern that some of the things that are in the Bible are really there, but you just have to know that they're there rather than actually read them there. Things like a fully developed devil figure is not in the Bible. Antichrist is not in the Bible. These sorts of things. Even the rapture is not really a biblical idea. It's based on things that come out of the Bible, but it's not described as such in the Bible. They would question all of that and say, yes, it is there. You just have to know where to look for it. But that kind of special pleading doesn't really work when you're looking at any ancient text. So you really have to try to take it on its own terms, which is what, as somebody who taught biblical studies and who studied it for a number of years, that's what you're trained to do, is try to take it on its own terms. And so I don't know. I would have to, I'd be curious. I'm more than glad to interact with people, but I just don't know.
Yeah. Listeners, let us know what you think.
I have one final question, and I'm very distressed that it is the final question.
Oh, no.
But I know, because we're running out of time, of course, as we usually do. What is your favorite horror movie that uses this type of symbology?
Yeah,
that's a good one.
A really tough question to answer, too. I have to keep coming back to saying that I think in many respects, it's The Exorcist. I saw that late. I was in my mid-40s when I saw it. I was raised as an evangelical Christian. I was not inclined to see it, and I was afraid to see it. But it had a real impact, even though this was in the, you know, at that point, I was in the new millennium, and I still found it a very frightening movie. And I know many people today don't find it so frightening, but I would say that I want to temper that off against the Conjuring series, which is really still unfolding, of course, which also takes the basic idea of Catholics have to be the ones to fight these demons, okay? That Ed and Lorraine Warren in real life were Roman Catholic, or at least were Catholic. Some question about what exactly they believed. But they are the main characters in this series, and they are constantly having to fight against demons that are coming at them from various directions. And I find that really compelling, even when the movies aren't that great. The one that came out this past summer, The Devil Made Me Do It, I thought was kind of a weak link in the series. But still, it had that kind of, it's compelling. It's compelling, and it's straightforward horror as horror, whereas I'm sure that The Exorcist, some people would say, was not intended as a horror movie. It's more intended as a drama, and certainly Blatty's idea behind it was that it was a question of faith. So that was not intended as horror.
I have one final question. I'm so sorry. I'm just curious. You talking about that made me think. Studying horror for you is it fair to say that studying horror for you is a spiritual practice?
Yes, I would say absolutely so. It helps me make sense of things because, you know, as you experience life, you're taught certain truths about the way things work out. And before you get too old, or maybe in some cases you get pretty old, you find out that it doesn't really work that way. And so life is a kind of a discovery, a journey of discovery. And I found that a lot of times the horror movies help me with that. They're along the same path, and a lot of times raising the questions that were probably in my mind all along, but I just didn't know it. And so these movies often have a bit more going on than you'd think. I find that people claim that horror movies are facile and that they're puerile and they're just, you know, for cheap thrills. They're not. Many of them aren't. Some of them are, yes, but many of them have much more profound things going on. And that's, I think that they can be a spiritual practice. I've actually toyed with the idea of writing a book about it. I haven't gotten very far with that
yet. You should. You should.
Yeah. The spiritual practice of watching horror.
Mm-hmm. Yes. I will be on the pre-order list.
Thank you.
All right, Deborah, over to you.
Well,
our closer.
I'm always the bad guy having to close us down here. But Dr. Wiggins, once again, we have so enjoyed our time with you. This was really, really a fun discussion. And listeners, please check out Dr. Wiggins's website, stevewiggins.com, and his books are available on Amazon.
Thank you, thank you, thank you again.
Thank you.
Again, thank you so much. Thank you for listening to the Incarcerated Christian Podcast. We invite you to rate and review our show. And remember, you can find this interview and others on our website, theincarceratedchristian.com, or anywhere you access podcasts. Don't forget to connect with us on Instagram and TikTok at The Incarcerated Christian and on Twitter at @TICC_podcast_. You can find more information about us and our show on our website. Again, that's theincarceratedchristian.com. Until next time, go forth in love and light.